Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday morning. Egypt and Syria are focal points of discussion this hour of the program. In Egypt, the main opposition alliance has called for a no vote in the referendum on a disputed constitution rather than a boycott of this. The opposition's decision did not dispel what has been called a nation in crisis. They are polarized over the referendum. There have been 3 weeks of demonstrations on the streets. The opposition is planning more demonstrations on the streets, and the judges of that country are on strike over a decree by Morsi that placed him above judicial oversight. That decree has been rescinded since. The military is inching back into politics. The economy is not doing very well. And people are wondering what exactly is the design that Morsi has for the future of Egypt and for his own future. The first half hour of our program today, Mona El-Gobashi is our guest, assistant professor of political science at Barnard College, where she specializes in democratization in the Middle East and also in North Africa. Later this hour, we will be talking about Syria, where, as you know, the opposition gained the support of the Obama administration earlier this week. And, of course, there is front page news today that missile attacks on rebels have escalated the war in Syria. We'll be welcoming phone calls all hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. The Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Professor El-Gobashi, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Tell me first, what is in this constitutional referendum? What does it say?
Well, the constitutional referendum is a up and down yes or no vote on the draft charter, which is 236 articles. The draft charter was worked on by a committee of 100 elected public figures and legislators, and they've been working on this draft document for 5.5 months, pretty much away from the public limelight. Everything came to a head, though, with the November 21st decrees by President Morsi, which plunged the country into the crisis that you described earlier.
Mm-hmm. And tell us more about those decrees. What are they?
Well, they were a series of decrees that the president said he needed to pass in order to help him get things done. The reason why they're so controversial, however, is that one part of the decrees exempted all his decisions from judicial review. Egypt has a very established tradition of judicial review, and this raised the hackles of many, many people, human rights activists and ordinary citizens, who are offended by the idea of a president putting himself above judicial inspection. The other part of the decrees that was also highly controversial was a very ambiguously worded clause that said that the president can do anything necessary to, quote, protect the revolution.
A piece in the Washington Post yesterday said that the decree over the country's judges has been rescinded. Is that true?
That is true. After the massive public protests against the decrees of November 21st, President Morsi eventually backtracked, canceled that decree entirely, and held out a hand to the opposition to negotiate. He also produced a new decree that was much more modest in its reach, but he canceled the idea of exempting himself from judicial review. Yet he didn't cancel the referendum, which was the opposition's main demand, and that's why Egyptians are gearing up for two consecutive Saturdays of voting starting the day after tomorrow.
Those who are in favor of this referendum say that it does contain articles that would ban many human rights abuses that were a part of the Mubarak regime. Does it do that?
Well, this is where the point of contention lies. Advocates of the Constitution say that they've spent 5.5 months producing a document that aims to fulfill all the aspirations of the January 25th revolution. It protects individual rights, particularly when it comes to arresting citizens, and this is a direct response to Mubarak's police state. It protects social justice and all sorts of economic rights. It includes very positive language about women's rights in the preamble, although the expected article on gender equality was eventually taken away because the warring sides couldn't agree on how to word provisions about gender equality. Critics of the Constitution, on the other hand, claim that it doesn't have sufficient protections of rights. It still includes certain areas where, for instance, civilians may be tried by military courts. And they're also unhappy about some of the religious language in the Constitution, although that religious language doesn't depart too much from what already existed in the 1971 Constitution.
Mm-hmm. There have been some critics who have said that what we're witnessing is a power grab by Morsi and that he is playing a game with a longer goal, the ultimate goal of a rigid Islamic state, no longer open to democratic freedoms or aligned with Western interest. Are you worried about that? Is that his ultimate goal? Do we know his ultimate goal?
I'm familiar with that argument. I don't think that anybody really understands what his ultimate goal is. Mm. He's saying that he was simply trying to protect the constitutional process from being disbanded by the courts. The courts have, on a previous occasion, disbanded the Constitutional Committee and forced it to reform under a new banner. And so his argument was that he was simply trying to put in place elected institutions so that Egyptians can get on with their political lives and have checks and balances. Others, and these tend to be people who are suspicious of the Organization of the Muslim Brothers from which the president hails, believe that this is some sort of a long-term strategy to exert dominance over the Egyptian political arena. I don't subscribe to that particular point of view. I think this is a case of executive overreach rather than a dictatorial power grab.
Give us a little better understanding of him. Time magazine had an interesting piece on him recently in which they looked at his studies in the United States, said that he has warm feelings about the states. He's a big University of Southern California football fan. He also is an active member in the Muslim Brotherhood. So talk about both of those parts of his life.
Mohamed Morsi was a conservative party leader. He was the leader of the Muslim Brotherhood Party that, of course, gained prominence after the revolution. And as expected, they gained 47% of the seats in the first parliamentary elections after the revolution. And they also surprised all Egyptians and international observers by winning the presidency. But he won the presidency by a very slim mandate. He got 51% of the votes back in June when the presidential election was concluded. The reason why Morsi has been somewhat of a controversial figure is that he wasn't the Muslim Brotherhood's first choice for the presidency. He was their stand-in, as it were, because their first choice was disqualified by the military, which controlled Egypt at that time. However, after Morsi ascended to the presidency in June, he surprised observers again by taking the military out of politics and establishing the hegemony of the elected presidency. And he got quite a bit of support for that maneuver back in August. And he was doing relatively well until these November 21st decrees that then gathered together various sorts of opposition against him.
Mm-hmm. And what is the role of the military now?
Well, that's an interesting question because it was thought that by August the military had gone back to the barracks and Egypt was moving forward towards civilian control of the military and some sort of accommodation where the military would have their economic privileges intact, including protecting those privileges in the draft charter, in the constitution that Egyptians are voting on, but that they would no longer play a direct role in politics. That appeared to change somewhat in the current crisis because on Tuesday, the military came out with this very odd proposal. The Minister of Defense came out in a press conference calling on all the warring political forces to sit down for lunch in this social event that he called a coming together of the Egyptian family. Soon after that proposal and invitation was sent out, the military canceled that event, citing lack of participation. And the real reasons behind that are probably a power struggle right now between the civilian head of the Egyptian executive, that is President Morsi, and the military, who tried to somehow intervene and try to broker the crisis in a much more direct way.
Mm-hmm. What kind of relationship does the Muslim Brotherhood have with Hamas?
Well, the Muslim Brothers is the main Islamist organization from which all other Islamist organizations in the Middle East and North Africa are inspired. And so they do have links with Hamas. The Egyptian Muslim Brothers are sort of like the mother movement. And Hamas, particularly the government in Gaza, see the Muslim Brothers as natural allies. And that kind of alliance was cemented days before Morsi issued his decrees, when he brokered the ceasefire in Gaza and was given much international accolades for getting the Israelis and the Palestinians to stop their hostilities. And the Obama administration was very, very positive on President Morsi. And many critics actually say that the Obama administration continues to support Morsi despite his executive overreach and the current crisis in Egypt right now.
Mm-hmm. That same article said that he seems to have access at any time of the day, 2:30 in the morning, and then another phone call at 5 o'clock in the morning to the president.
That's correct. And Obama did call President Morsi on Wednesday night when there were very serious clashes between Morsi supporters and anti-Morsi demonstrators outside the presidential palace that led to the death so far of 9 people.
Mm-hmm. And does he deserve a good deal of the credit, as much credit as Hillary Clinton, more credit in working out this ceasefire negotiation between Israel and Hamas?
Well, he certainly was on a mission, even before this ceasefire, to create a more creative foreign policy for Egypt, to bring Egypt back into its role as a major regional player. And that was part of the reason why many people were positive. They saw Morsi as doing much more positive and creative work than Mubarak had ever done to craft a foreign policy. So he does deserve some credit. It was, of course, very closely scripted with the American administration, each of his foreign policy maneuvers, most especially the truce between Gaza and Israel. However, many people are criticizing Morsi precisely for this, calling him essentially a stooge or an ally of the Americans, and that he coordinates each and every one of his policy maneuvers with the Americans so that he doesn't unsettle American interests. He's actually a very faithful guardian of American interests in Egypt.
It makes it pretty difficult to figure out who in the world he is, doesn't it?
Well, as a newly elected president, the first elected president in a country that where the presidency has been a institution that has always been not only unelected but dominated by the military, it's not surprising in the long historical term to see someone who is someone who's hard to make sense of, because the office itself, after a revolution, the office itself is quite a fragile endeavor and still in formation. And the current crisis, again from a historical perspective, can be seen as simply one more chapter in this very prolonged drama of what the new Egyptian presidency is going to look like.
Professor, how has he responded? And tell me about how substantial the street protests have been.
Well, these street protests took everyone by surprise, most of all the president himself. The Muslim Brothers, the organization from which he hails, is the most organized political force in Egypt. It was able to withstand decades of repression by not just the Mubarak regime, but the Sadat and the Nasser regime. Many of their leading members were placed in prison. Many of them were executed. And they developed this sort of mythical status as a hyper-organized movement that has a presence in all of the nation's major cities and in all of the neighborhoods, and they have an extensive grassroots network and so on, which they now are actually using to get out the vote for the referendum. Because of this, because the Muslim Brothers is the strongest political force in Egypt, it took everybody by surprise to see protests in the tens of thousands against Morsi, not just in Cairo, the capital city, and not just in the second city of Alexandria, but in almost all the major provincial cities. There were substantial protests that were not organized by any form of an opposition, but by these revolutionary forces on the ground. And these protests surprised people because we didn't expect the extent of opposition to Morsi to actually be sustained from November 21st till the present day.
We welcome phone calls for our guest, and here's how you can reach us, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We thought we would spend time today looking at the Middle East and two countries that have been much in the news, certainly Egypt, and it will be more in the news as this week goes on, because there is a referendum on a disputed constitution, which is taking place on Saturday, although people who are living in other countries who are Egyptian have already started the process of voting. Later this hour, we'll be talking with the former U.S. ambassador to Iraq, Turkey, and Albania, and looking at what is going on in Syria, where the civil war has gone on for a long time and escalated this week. week with missile attacks on rebels. So join our conversation. I gave you the number. You can join us whenever you'd like. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this half hour is Professor Mona L. Gobashi, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Barnard College. And we're talking about Egypt and welcoming your phone calls. Just a short period of time for you to call in if you would like to do so. 800-486-8655 is our number. Can you tell me about the number of Egyptians who are living outside of Egypt who have already started voting on this constitution?
That's right. Expatriate voters have already started going to the polls in their respective embassies starting on Wednesday. The turnout has been pretty healthy, particularly in the Arab countries where most expatriate Egyptians reside. And so far, there have been no reports of any kind of foul play or intimidation of voters or pressuring of voters, which is what the opposition fears for Egypt on Saturday. So as a result, the opposition is already starting to engage in its own version of mobilizing voters, particularly after the opposition came out yesterday and officially called on voters to go to the polls and to vote no. And their goal is, knowing that they face a highly organized cadres of the Muslim Brothers, their goal is to get something like 30% no vote, which would be a signal to Morsi that this constitution is indeed deeply contested and he needs to play more of a consensual brokering role to change some of the provisions that they don't like.
Give me an idea. Things don't go very well for any administration if the economy is in very rough shape. Have things picked up in Egypt since he took office or not?
Well, since the decrees, things were not as bad as they had been initially in 2011, but since the decrees, the economy has taken a sharp turn for the worst. In fact, because of the unrest, the IMF canceled or postponed a major loan that it was negotiating with Egypt, a $4.8 billion loan, until the political situation stabilizes somewhat. The Egyptian pound has been heavily devalued, so Egyptians' purchasing power is even less and less by every day. And then in the midst of this crisis, in a kind of puzzling act, Morsi first issued some significant tax increases, a sales tax increase as well as a tax increase on certain things like cigarettes, which many people in Egypt use, and then he immediately, almost 24 hours later, postponed that tax measure. It's still a puzzling thing why he did that. Some people say that it was an attempt to gain back some public opinion to show that he cared about people, and so he would postpone the tax increases. Other people say that this is just more of the seeming executive disorganization in his office right now ever since November 21st.
So what do you think? Is he kind of learning on the job?
I think that's exactly what's happening. I think that he, first of all, made a series of miscalculations because he overestimated the extent of his power. He also was acting, when he acknowledged this, he was acting because he felt under threat from the holdovers of the Mubarak regime, certain members of the judiciary, certain members of the security forces, and certainly the police. He literally felt that as a president, he doesn't have control over all of these institutions. So his argument for passing the controversial decrees was to give the president more power in order to be able to do these very important things against the resistance of entrenched authoritarian segments of the Egyptian state.
When you look at what happened, how long ago was it now that Mubarak was overthrown?
Mubarak officially stepped down on February 11th, 2011.
So it's been almost 2 years. Are you surprised by what's happened in the last 2 years? Are any of your expectations of what could happen for the good for Egypt been met or not?
Well, political scientists often tend to take a very detached point of view when they see all of this happening. It seems very familiar to us because we know that transitions from authoritarian rule are extremely messy, prolonged affairs, that there are always backtracking, that democracy is an entirely fragile thing. It doesn't necessarily, we don't expect there to be a unilinear process of progress. So as a political scientist, none of this is at all surprising. And in fact, Egypt, by comparison to other states that were transitioning, is pretty much in the middle. It's not terribly bad. But as an Egyptian citizen, of course, I don't have that same detached perspective. Particularly in the past 2 weeks of crisis, it's been very, very sobering. And rather sad to see many people die. For instance, there was a funeral for a young journalist who died yesterday that turned into a massive demonstration against the president and his party. And that's something that I think many Egyptians and outside observers are very saddened and concerned about.
Mm-hmm. And give me a better understanding of the scope of the opposition here. Who are the people who are most vociferous in their opposition? Is it all kinds of groups? Is there a dominant group?
Yes, that's a good question. We can think of them as two segments of the opposition. There's the street-based opposition, all of the youth groups, the revolutionary youth groups all over the country, and these are the ones who are really firing up and populating the street protests. At the elite level, the opposition is made up of three very prominent Egyptian politicians, two of whom were former presidential candidates who ran against and lost against Morsi in 2005. And it's led by the national coordinator, Mohamed El-Baradei, who is, of course, the very famous Egyptian diplomat who used to be the head of the International Atomic Energy Association. This particular organization, they call themselves the National Salvation Front. They're the ones now who are trying to keep the pressure on Morsi. They're the ones who called on Egyptians yesterday to boycott, to vote no in the referendum. And they, knowing that they face, of course, a stacked battle because they cannot match the organization of the Muslim Brothers, they also pointed out yesterday that even if the referendum passes on the Constitution, they will continue the struggle to, as they put it, end the dominance of the Muslim Brothers over Egyptian politics.
And what happens if the referendum doesn't pass?
If the referendum does not pass, Morsi's recent decree stipulates that there would be a new procedure where Egyptians would actually directly elect the 100 constitution writers. So the first thing that would happen if the referendum does not pass is the law organizing these elections would start to take place, and Egyptians would go to the polls again, this time not to vote up and down on a constitution, but to select 100 constitution writers, which is what happened in Tunisia in their revolution back in October.
Mm-hmm. And Morsi has said that this is democracy. What's happening is democracy. This is the beginning of a new government. This is not unusual.
That's right. Morsi's argument and the argument of his political party is that this is democracy, meaning that elections are the means by which we do politics. And his argument against the opposition is that the opposition is afraid of elections because they know that they can't get out as many voters. So that's why they are, as he says, obstructing this process by continually calling for street protests and by continually calling for the delay of the referendum. There's something to be said for his argument. At the same time, though, because this is a very fragile democratizing process, because right now there is no parliament, it was dissolved in June, because there are no institutions that really oversee the presidency in any effective fashion, he should have governed in a much more consensual manner, and he should have taken into account the points of view of these important minorities to create some sense of an inclusion. If he had done that, the crisis that we're currently witnessing right now would probably have been much, much less severe.
Mm. Mona, thank you so much for all of your expertise.
Thank you very much for having me.
Our guest, the first part of this hour, Mona El-Ghobashi, assistant professor of political science at Barnard College, and she hails from Egypt. We are going to continue our focus on the Middle East. We thought we would pick two countries where a lot is going on. The other is Syria. And we have a new guest with us. First, let me tell you that you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we certainly welcome phone calls from you, or you can send us an email, or you can put a message on our Facebook page. We're moving to Syria this hour, and our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Ambassador James Jeffrey is our guest now, former U.S. ambassador to Iraq, Turkey, and Albania. He was the Deputy National Security Advisor in the George W. Bush administration from 2007 to 2008 and is currently a visiting fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Ambassador Jeffrey, thank you very much for being with us. Good morning.
Thank you for having us. Hello out there in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's start with what is certainly news today and yesterday, where the Assad forces have restored to firing Scud missiles at rebel fighters inside Syria. A significant escalation in this war?
I don't think so. A significant escalation would have been to have used chemical weapons, but they appear to have been deterred by that. Scuds are not particularly, as we know from 1991, and in the Iran-Iraq war, they are not, they're what we call area weapons, not precision weapons. They will terrorize the population more, but frankly, the population has already been terrorized by the indiscriminate use of artillery and bombs, including what the State Department describes as barrel bombs filled with incendiaries. Essentially, the Assad government will use any conventional military capability it has to try to basically hold the civilian population hostage because it can't win on the battlefield.
Where were these reports coming from that chemical weapons were going to be used?
They were coming from intelligence sources. I can't get into the details because, frankly, I don't know which intelligence services based upon which information. But I can judge from experience that the certainty with which American officials spoke of preparations, including the mixing of the two components of sarin gas, strongly indicates that this was American intelligence and that it was concrete intelligence, not agent reporting.
Can you please tell us, Ambassador, why this goes on and on and on? So many people have been killed, two-year-old conflict. Do we see any possibility of a break here?
Well, it'll be, I mean, what we were dealing with is a war. We've seen wars since time immemorial, and when you have wars, whether it's us in World War II or Vietnam or others, the two sides typically fight until one or another wins. It is a false assumption on our part to think that there is simply an absence of communication, or the international community hasn't tried hard enough, we haven't picked the right UN advisor, or America doesn't have quite the right policy, and that therefore that's why the fighting goes on. The fighting goes on because you have a dictatorial minority government in Syria that is holding on to power against an uprising that's quite popular, at least among the Sunni majority in the country. And that minority will not give up power. One of the reasons it will not give up power is that you have three other conflicts going on here that are regional or international in nature. One is Iran's effort to use Syria as a platform to advance its hegemonial ambitions in the region, and particularly as a platform to support Hezbollah and, to some degree, Hamas. The rockets that were fired from Gaza into Israel last month were largely Iranian. And if it loses Syria, then Iran will lose that whole arm of its regional power projection. So that's the first level. The second level is a struggle between the Shia and Sunnis of the region to try to work out a way to come together. We've seen that in the past in Iraq. We see it in some degree in Pakistan, even in Afghanistan under the Taliban. We see it in Bahrain. It's below the surface, but it is very much present. It motivates some of the people who are supplying arms, particularly to the more radical groups in Syria, and it's of great concern to us. At the final and third level, there is obviously a struggle on the part of Russia and to a lesser extent China to ever since the Balkan Wars and then Libya, to reduce the ability of the United States to overturn governments, however distasteful these governments might be, because the Russians see that not as a step in the right direction for democracy and a peaceful world, but rather an expansion of American power. And therefore, the Russians have an interest in keeping Assad in power as long as possible, although they clearly today are having second thoughts.
Hmm. And Ambassador Jeffrey, let's go into a little bit more detail on each of those points. How is Iran using Syria as a platform? What are they doing?
Well, first of all, they use Syria. Syria is the only nation state that is in the rejectionist front against Israel. While the Syrians did nothing against Israel because they're one of the Golan Heights area kept quiet, Syria, because it had a territorial claim and in many respects an understandable one on the Golan Heights taken in 1967, Syria refused to make peace and aligned itself constantly with the most radical anti-Israeli forces in the Middle East. Iran, which of course is neither Sunni Arab like the Palestinians nor Arab like the Palestinians, saw support for Syria and an alliance with Syria as a way to project itself as the real legitimate defender of the Palestinian people and opponent of Israel in the region. So it was using that as a vehicle to make a claim for leadership in the Middle East. Secondly, and very explicitly, Iran uses Syria as the transportation belt for sending rockets, weapons, people, money, and other equipment, and including advisors to the Hezbollah movement in southern Lebanon, the Bekaa Valley, and Beirut itself. This has led to a huge expansion of that movement, including its militia. We saw that in 2006 in the fighting against Israel. We see it in the composition of the current Lebanese government, which to some degree is under the thumb of Hezbollah right now. And this is all much to Iran's advantage. It all goes away if a new regime comes to power that first and foremost is going to remember that it was Iran and Hezbollah who popped up Assad.
Mm-hmm. Is it significant that the U.S., this was announced this week, the president said we would formally recognize the coalition of Syrian opposition groups as that country's legitimate representative? A couple questions here. Is that meaningful? And can you tell me more about the nature of those opposition groups?
Well, first of all, it is a meaningful and it's a good but overdue step. Secondly, it's actually political recognition. As the State Department spokesman made clear yesterday in the daily press briefing, this is not legal recognition. That is, we have not, we still have the current Assad government's embassy legally on the books as the legal representative. Basically, we have politically acknowledged that movement as the legitimate representative of the Syrian people, and we have opened up political contacts with it. So this is a major step, but it isn't the final step. In terms of that movement in comparison to the earlier Syrian coalition that we dealt with has more people who have either recently come out of Syria or still maintain contacts in Syria, in local villages and in some of the cities that have been liberated, and have closer ties to the actual fighters. That was a major concern with the various groups that we were dealing with before, exile groups who did not have very good ties with folks inside the country. We saw that movie in 2003 in Iraq, and we want to have as much contact with people who are on the ground. The problem is that this is a collection of many different groups, a good number of them, including some of the best fighters, such as the Jabhat al-Nusra, Nusri group, are what we would call fundamental Islamic groups with ties to al-Qaeda, and these are very significant and very detailed ties, and they are being supported by the same funding sources in the Gulf that we saw in the past supporting the Taliban, supporting al-Qaeda in Pakistan and Afghanistan. So that's of great concern to us. On the other hand, as I said, it's a very eclectic collection of groups. Many of them are Islamic. There's a strong Sunni Islamic flavor to the entire thing. And it's very hard to sort out who is what and who will do what, rather similar to what we saw in Libya.
Hmm. Well, how can we support organizations that are part of al-Qaeda?
Well, we've taken a position explicitly that we will not, and the State Department spokeswoman, Toria Nuland, made that exactly completely clear yesterday. The United States discourages people from providing support to this al-Nusra group and to any other groups that are associated with al-Qaeda. That said, there are all sorts of gradations and colorations in any insurgency. I went through this in Iraq. I went through this in other countries. It's very difficult to sort out who is what and who has ties to whom, because, frankly, everybody has ties to everybody. The underlying question we have at this point is it in the U.S. national interest to see Assad fall? I think the answer is yes. Unless we think that that is inevitable and that it is irrelevant to us, what emerges from that, we need to get more active more quickly and have as much influence as possible over the resistance as a whole.
But you're saying, reading between the lines or hearing between the lines, that we may not be happy with who's in power once Assad is gone?
Well, I would say that many Americans, including many in the American government, aren't particularly happy with what's emerged in Egypt. We have our problems with my former interlocutor, Prime Minister Maliki, in Iraq. We've had our ups and downs with Prime Minister Erdogan, who's also of Turkey, who's also heads a what people call a moderate Islamic party, but he comes from an Islamic Muslim brother background. That's the new Middle East.
And that's okay? I mean, that's what we have to live with.
Well, okay is it is based upon an implicit assumption that the United States has the responsibility, the right, and the authority and the desire, and I'm talking about the American politician, not a handful of people who do this for a living like me, to actually determine what's right and what's wrong in governing 190 countries around the world.
Right.
I would question that.
Right. Let's welcome phone calls for you. Here's our phone number. We have placed our attention on Syria, but our guests can also talk. Our focus this hour is Egypt and Syria. Ambassador James Jeffrey is now a visiting fellow at the Washington Institute, where he focuses on U.S. strategies to counter Iran's efforts to expand its influence in the broader Middle East. We're talking about Syria with him and welcoming phone calls, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. The Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Ambassador Jeffrey is former U.S. ambassador to Iraq, Turkey, and Albania. He was the deputy national security advisor in the George W. Bush administration from 2007 to 2008. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Just a reminder, we have a book club in existence, and next week is our next book club. We are reading Civil Disobedience by Henry David Thoreau. There is a link to the text on our website and also on our Facebook page, so you can easily get a hold of the book, and we'll talk about it next week. Let's go to phone calls for Ambassador James Jeffrey. Our number again, 800-486-8655. Mary in Wausau. Hi.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I had a question. I've been hearing reports of many Christians being killed by the rebels in Syria. Even Ivan Haddad, who is from Homs, Syria, has mentioned on YouTube, she has a clip, that all the churches in Homs have been destroyed, that 200 Christians have been killed in Homs by the rebels. And were under Assad, they were, you know, could basically live, you know, not comfortably, but they could at least be living. It seems like the rebels, you know, if we support the rebels, there'll be a mass murder of all the rest of the Christians as well in Syria. So are we saving, you know, helping the rebels to kill all the Christians there, or what is your take on that?
First of all, we're really not helping the rebels do anything, which is one of my complaints. Secondly, one way that we can have some influence on what rebels do and don't do is to provide them essential help. As we're not providing that essential help, we don't have much control over what they do. That said, there's two answers to what you raised. And first of all, you raised a very, very important point that has us all concerned. It has us concerned. It had us concerned in Iraq. It has us concerned elsewhere, including even in Egypt. And that is the problem between political movements drawing their inspiration from Islam and Christian communities. Secular leaders, however totalitarian, the Ba'athist leaders in Iraq, Saddam, and in Syria, Assad, and the regime of the generals from Sadat on through Mubarak, were basically quite concerned about no harm coming to the Christian communities, in part because of their reputation internationally, as they were in trouble on other issues, in part because they were saw religion as part of the enemy, saw Islam as part of the enemy. This is all changing with the rise of both Islamic movements and democracy, given that democracy gives power to the people, and most people in these countries believe that religion, specifically Islam, should play a larger role. That is not inconsistent with tolerance for minorities. We saw this in the Ottoman Empire, for example, but it does require more work. In terms of specifics, I would caution you on statistics that have not been verified by outside reporters and by a lot of different sourcing. We saw a lot of that in Iraq. They tend to be exaggerated. That said, this is a very, very big problem.
What is the essential help you believe we should be giving the rebels in Syria?
We should be giving them military equipment. We should be giving them advisory teams. We should be giving them financial means, sharing intelligence with them, helping them plan their operations. We want to end this as soon as possible. As your listener made reference to, there are all kinds of downsides if the wrong people get into positions of power in Syria. We will exchange one problem, which is, I think, a strategic problem in the region, for another problem, which will be a very serious problem for human rights and for the future of Syria and for democracy and peace.
And do you think we have a good enough handle on who it is we want to support among those opposition forces?
We never will. And that should not be a prerequisite for going in. If we know a group like the al-Nusra group is definitely associated with al-Qaeda, we should stay away from them and encourage others. But basically, if you make as a prerequisite knowing who is our friends in an eclectic resistance of various Muslim groups in a country that has not had much contact with the outside world, that's a recipe for doing nothing. It's in our interest to do something. We will make mistakes. We will give weapons to the wrong people. We did it in Afghanistan in the 1980s, and a lot of bad things flew from that. But what also flew from that was the end of the Soviet Union, and that was a pretty big victory.
Go back to what you were saying. I can't remember if you said Russia reconsidering their support for Assad or China or both. What support are they giving, and what form is their reconsideration taking?
China has always been less comfortable, and I'll come to China in a second, but let's focus on the main player, and that is Russia. Russia signed up to a series of principles in Geneva called the Geneva Agreement back in June that called for the gradual dismissal of the Assad regime in an interim government. The Russians have been backtracking from that. They have an interest in keeping the Assad regime in power. They see Assad as an ally. They see the pressure on him as a manifestation, as I said, of America's illegitimate efforts to determine the makeup of countries. And they may have a very, very lucrative arms business with Assad. And finally, they have a base on the Mediterranean coast given to them by the current Syrian government. So the Russians have, and finally, to be cynical about this, Russia's primary export and primary support for its economy is oil and gas exports. The more chaos there is in the Middle East, dear gas and oil will be, the better the Russian economy. The more stable the Middle East, the more likely that countries like Iraq and eventually Iran can be exporting millions of barrels more of oil, and thus drives the price down. China, on the other hand, does not have the same interest. But getting back to where Russia is right now, the Russians did agree over the last weekend to have at the deputy foreign minister level, it was Deputy Foreign Minister Bogdanov who met with our Deputy Secretary of State, Bill Burns, to talk about possible ways forward, possible compromises and such on the basis of the June Geneva agreement. Now, the Russians immediately came out at a higher level, Foreign Minister Lavrov, to say that this didn't represent moving away from the Assad government, but it still was a step forward. Furthermore, Bogdanov, the same fellow who was in the meeting with Burns over the weekend, came out today and said that it does look like the Assad regime is going down. That's the first time that the Russians have made such a statement. The Chinese, as I said, want a stable, calm, peaceful Middle East because they are terribly dependent upon Middle Eastern hydrocarbons. Secondly, the Chinese are clearly concerned about the isolation that both China and Russia find themselves in internationally, beginning in the UN and in the UN General Assembly, over the issue of Syria, because practically no one anywhere in the world other than China, Russia, and Iran is supporting the Assad regime.
Let's go. Mary, thanks for your call. Fred, and our number, by the way, is 800-486-8655, or shoot us an email at talk@wpr.org. Fred in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi. You mentioned Hezbollah and Hamas. Who are they, and which side are they on, and how much effect do they have not only in Syria but the whole area?
That's a very good question. Hezbollah is a Shia Arab religious movement that began in the 1980s in basically out of resistance to the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1982. It was people linked to Hezbollah, supported by Iran, who attacked our Marine barracks in 1983 and twice our embassy at the same time. And they led the resistance against the Israelis. The Israelis finally left at the end of the 1990s, but then they had to come back in 2006 because Hezbollah began attacking Israel. Hezbollah is basically, in many respects, both a major political player in Lebanon and a foreign policy and military arm of the Iranians. Hamas is very different. Hamas is an offshoot of the Muslim Brothers among the Palestinians, particularly strong in Gaza. Hamas supports a radical position. They will not recognize Israel, and they are continuing the armed struggle, which, of course, in Oslo, the main Palestinian movement, Fatah, gave up back in 1993. So there's a basic difference. Hamas, of course, is in control in Gaza, and they have considerable support among the Palestinians. Up until recently, Hamas was as much a, not quite a tool of the Iranians, but had very close relations with Iran. And Hamas's leader, Mashal, was located in Syria, essentially under Assad's and Iranian protection. However, because Hamas is a Muslim Brother Sunni Arab movement, and because many of the most of the resistance to Assad is coming from the country's Sunni Arab population, it grew very uncomfortable, and the Hamas leadership left Damascus for Egypt last year. On the other hand, the Hamas people did benefit from Iranian weapons and particularly rocket deliveries to rain these rockets down on Israel last month during the Shahed conflict there. And so it goes back and forth. Hamas is easier to break off from Iran than Hezbollah is. Hezbollah is tied to it through religion and shared interests.
And finally, we're coming up on the second anniversary of the overthrow of Mubarak in Egypt, the Arab Spring. Could you have pretty much predicted that we'd be where we are now, or did you have much higher hopes of democracy flourishing in a different fashion in many of these countries?
I think we're doing pretty well. I'm not surprised that Morsi has taken the turn that he did. I've seen that in Iraq. On the other hand, I was encouraged by the Tahrir Square demonstrations and the fact that he did take a step back when faced with public pressure. We have seen that again and again, both in Turkey and in Iraq. The important thing to remember is while these people may not have our same views of pluralism and democracy as laid out by our founding fathers, they do respect the power of the people and the power of the vote. And that is a huge step forward compared to what we've seen with the Assads, with the Saddams, even with the Mubaraks. So in that sense, I think it's going along pretty well. Where we've seen democracy develop in Korea, in Taiwan, in the Philippines, in Central America, in South America, even in Greece and Turkey, we've seen it come with fits and starts. We've seen setbacks. We've seen military coups. It's a 30, 40, 50-year process, and we shouldn't be surprised that we're seeing the same thing happen in Egypt.
Mm-hmm. And would you like to comment on the referendum on the Constitution? Where do you think that's going to go?
The Constitution is...
In Egypt. I'm sorry, in Egypt.
In Egypt, of course. The Constitution it has very strong Islamic elements, not unlike those seen in the Iraqi Constitution, but very different, for example, from what is in the current Turkish Constitution, which is very strictly secular. I think that there's a fair possibility that the population will vote for this. While we look at some of these things as very troubling, while they outline basic rights, including for women and minorities and other religious groups, they also have vague language about the family and cultural values and Sharia, that is Islamic religious jurisprudence, as a source of law that can allow both judges and legislators and muftis to reinterpret the constitutional rights in a way that basically divest them of much of their value. So we have to watch that. But on the other hand, I don't think that a majority of the Egyptian population will see it that way. And I'm fairly confident that the referendum will pass. And I frankly would like to see it not pass.
Mm. Ambassador Jeffrey, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having us on your show.
Yeah, our pleasure. Professor Ambassador James Jeffrey, former U.S. Ambassador to Iraq, Turkey, and Albania. He was Deputy National Senior Advisor in the George W. Bush administration from 2007 to 2008. Thanks to Brett Jaspers and Rhonda Fanning, who produced this program, and thanks for your involvement in the show. Hour two of our program, we're going to do an open line. We haven't done one in months, and it's a good way to, at the end of the year, to get some program suggestions of shows you'd like to have on between 9 and 11. So stay with us.